We were saddened to learn of Edward Albee's death last week. He was one of our country's most influential playwrights for many years. So for this week's bonus weekend podcast, we are revisiting an interview from 2003 with Mr. Albee and actors Marion Seldes and Brian Murray discussing their production of Beckett Albee. We're also paying tribute to two other icons of 20th century theater. In 1995, I spoke with Arthur Miller about Homely Girl, a collection of short stories he'd written. And in 2000, Bill Irwin and I talked about his fascination with Samuel Beckett. Enjoy. I'm Leonard Lopate, and this is WNYC 93.9, AM 820. We're online at WNYC.org. In his glowing review of Beckett Albee, Ben Brantley, the New York Times theater critic, says the pairing of these four one-act plays offers a fascinating glimpse into the essential similarities and differences between two of the 20th century's most significant playwrights. But that's not the only pairing in this production that's getting raves. The chemistry between its stars, Marion Seldes and Brian Murray, is being compared to all of the greats of the past, Lunton Fontanne, Jessica Tandy and Hume Cronyn, even Fred Astaire and Ginger Rogers. Well, you can catch them all at the Century Center for the Performing Arts. That's at East 15th Street. And I'm thrilled that it has brought Edward Albee, Marion Seldes, and Brian Murray back to the studios today. Hello.
Hello. Hello.
We're letting Fred Astaire and his wife perform only on Tuesdays.
she's your standby, Ginger.
That was amazing that Ben Brantley mentioned them. And also another critic, too.
Yeah, I saw two critics.
That's what surprised me, that another critic would also say Astaire and Rogers.
Have you ever danced together, the two of you?
It's all a dance.
The whole thing is an endless dance. We did a couple of steps in Play About the Baby, didn't we?
Yes.
Sort of pranced around a bit. But
Edward, haven't you called Chekhov and Beckett the playwrights you most admire? What is it about
this? I think I said of the 20th century playwrights, the three essential 20th century playwrights, I feel are Chekhov, who was the first 20th century playwright, Ibsen being the last 19th century playwright, and Pirandello, who was enormously important and nobody pays any attention to, and Beckett, who was the quintessential 20th century playwright for me.
And you got something different from each of them? I know Pirandello, you love to break down that fourth wall, and did.
All the time, yes, and truth and illusion and fantasy and reality and all the rest of the stuff. I think what I learned from Chekhov, that serious should also be funny, and funny should also be serious. And from Beckett, I learned beauty of writing, economy and precision, and maybe some darker thoughts.
But he also was funny, after all. In some Beckett, I'm thinking of Waiting for Godot more than these one acts. There's positively vaudevillian quality, which we see in your play, which is the second part of this performance.
My play, what's it called, Counting the Ways. You know, I wanted to call that play Scenes from a Marriage.
Bergman took it.
well, you know, you can't copyright a title, and I could have done that. But I thought it would be opportunistic, and so I didn't. But it is subtitled A Vaudeville, in that it is in 21 blackout scenes, or at the moment 20.
And that, what happened? One of them disappeared?
Yes.
Well, some of them are just one word long, so
that's right.
What happened? You put two words together and ended
a
scene?
All of a sudden you're missing a scene.
I remember how surprised some critics seemed to be that Sylvia was so funny, at least in its first act. But you've been writing funny all along, and this play is from 1976.
You mean The Goat, or who is,
yes,
Sylvia? Thank you.
I still call it Sylvia.
Because the play Sylvia was written by Pete Gurney.
Ah, oh, right.
About the dog.
Yes, in fact, I remember Sarah Jessica Parker doing quite wonderfully in that.
Yeah. Well, I you know, that's why, as I said, I like Chekhov more than Ibsen, because Chekhov is just as serious as Ibsen, just as socially concerned. But he does have an extraordinary sense of humor, which we don't get from Ibsen, at least in translation. I'm told that Norwegian audiences go to his plays and they fall on the floor laughing.
Hedda Gabler, just a laugh riot.
A knee slapper, you know. Brandt, a knee slapper.
What's also obvious in this production is that, at least in these plays, neither you nor Beckett rely very much on setting. There's a kind of an abstract quality to place in all of them. The couple in yours is obviously in their home, but we don't need to know what their home looks like very specifically.
I don't believe in kitchen sink sets. You know, that's the thing that I learned when I went to East Berlin for the first time in 1959, saw my first Brecht play at the Berliner Ensemble. Selective reality, just a choice of two or three things, gives you the entire illusion of where you are. It's cheaper, too.
Brian, wasn't the play about the baby the first time you ever appeared in an Albee play?
In an Albee play, yes, it was.
What about Beckett?
I did Lucky in Waiting for Godot when I was very, very young, about 18, and didn't really get it terribly well because I did that diatribe, the quack, quack, quack. That's the only other time I've done it.
How much of an adjustment is necessary when you shift from one playwright to the other?
Oh, nothing, really. I mean, the adjustment lies in the changing of the clothes as much as anything else. I mean, Marion has less time than I do. I have the whole of Footfalls to get into.
But Marion has two short
plays. Yeah, she has the two. I'm in the middle. But by the time the intermission happens, we can go out there and we feel so filled and grateful that we're able to do this. We're looking a little better and we're feeling quite perky and we enjoy going out there. It's a pleasure to change.
Well, you're also interacting, whereas you're doing
exactly.
Monologues.
The others
in the
are alone, yeah.
And Marion, you've become something of an Albee expert over the years. How many of his plays have been in?
Five.
Four, and then you were a standby in Tiny Alice.
Yes,
right?
But I was lucky enough to play, so.
How much did you have to pay Irene to get that?
You standby for Irene Wirth. That's not...
It was thrilling. It was wonderful to be there, just to be there, because the first play I ever did in New York was directed by John Gielgud, so Sir John then was there. And I remember being at that famous press conference that Edward held in the theater. It was a wonderful, even if I had not been lucky enough to play it. But to play those scenes with Gielgud was thrilling to me, and I love that play.
What about Beckett? Have you done him before?
Well, I wish I had invented a whole Beckett history because people expect me to have very serious opinions about him and so on. I find him absolutely fascinating. Every single thing I know about him, have gotten to know about him, and doing the plays. It's difficult. It's difficult because the element of acting that I rely on so much, which is what happens between the actor, or rather the play, and the audience, it's as if someone took that away from me. And I had to build up some kind of not fake confidence, but some kind of confidence to get me through. Now I'm not scared anymore.
Well, you rely a lot on your physicality in most of your performances, and here only your lips are visible in Not I. I've read that Beckett said that he wished he could reduce theater to a pair of blubbering lips.
Yes, yes.
Is it weird being only a disembodied mouth?
No. Because that's what it is. I think it's so inventive and amazing that he thought of this. I mean, one could say glibly, oh, well, it should be on radio. But there's something absolutely, I think, brilliant about a disembodied part of the body, the only thing you see on the stage. And to listen to something, I love to listen to music, so listening to a play doesn't seem that different to me.
And there's a real musicality to the Beckett
words. Oh, my God, the rhythms of it are. And he's so specific in the way he punctuates. You in a funny way, you can't go wrong. I think one's tendency is one to act it more. But it doesn't need that. That's not what he wants.
He used to tell actors to just say
please
the words.
Please don't act, just say it. Mm-hmm.
Well,
there's a hypnotic quality to
it. Oh, absolutely.
I was just thinking about Not I. Your eyes go in and out of focus. You're trying to focus mm-hmm. on the mouth, and mm-hmm. then you go back out of focus
yes.
again. But your mind never does.
No.
But your eyes keep doing that.
But it's also interesting that we do feel in the audience compelled to look at the mouth all the time. It doesn't really matter. I could close my eyes and mm-hmm. probably get almost as much out of the play, mm-hmm. knowing it's a live performance. But we still look.
Well, because he's a brilliant innovator. It's theater. It's something must be there.
Well, Ben Brantley suggested...
Of course, he did write a couple of radio plays.
Yes, indeed, yeah. Indeed.
But very cleverly with Embers, the radio play Embers he wrote. He wrote so that it also could be performed on stage just as effectively as on radio.
Yeah.
Ben Brantley suggested, I thought rather affectionately, that the near obliteration of self the Beckett pieces require must have been a bit harder for such finely seasoned hams to achieve. I don't know whether you think of yourself as a finely seasoned ham.
Finely seasoned is good.
Yes, that's good. Yes. Ham without the finely seasoned wouldn't be a compound.
I am a careful reader of reviews, and there's something that must be in the Times reviewer's mind about turkey and ham and so on, because I rarely get a review without some reference to it, and it hurts me terribly.
You're either in a turkey or you're being a ham, is that?
Well, I am the turkey and the ham.
Oh, no.
And it's very painful. It isn't funny to me. It hurts me.
You know, one of the interesting things about Beckett is you really do have to listen. I'm just thinking, I told many people this, but it's so wonderful, in a piece of monologue that Brian is doing between Marion's two performances, there is a sentence that to me is the essence of why Beckett is so extraordinary. There's a moment where the old guy is looking out into the dark at the window. Now, any other playwright would have written the following sentence, something like, out there, the vast dark. Any other playwright would have done that, and that's not bad. But think what Beckett wrote, out there, the dark vast.
Black vast.
It is so much more chilling.
It gives you chills. Exactly.
It's extraordinary.
Was it your idea to pair these four one-act plays?
I forget whose bright idea and correct idea it was.
But it's not the first time. It's been pointed out again and again that 40 years ago, Zeus Story was paired with Crap's Last Tape. And that was fortuitous for you at the time. You
it
were less
indeed.
Famous than Samuel Beckett
now. My first play.
Yeah. Was that a surprise to you?
Was what a surprise?
That they were put together and worked so well together?
I didn't think about it at the time. I hadn't read Crap's Last Tape, and it was being performed in German when I saw it for its world premiere. But I felt that I understood the play completely. I had a little trouble with my play, which followed.
Well, Zeus Story done nicely.
It was a happy pairing. I've learned so much from Beckett and admire him so much.
I wonder whether somewhere down the line you'd like to be paired with Pirandello or with Chekhov.
Probably, sure. Yeah.
Did they write one of
plays? I've directed a lot of Beckett, too, you know. And boy, have I learned from doing that.
We'll take a little break here, and we'll come back and find out what you've learned and more from... We're talking with Edward Albee, Marion Seldes, Brian Murray. Beckett Albee is now at the Century Center for the Performing Arts on East 15th Street. Stay with us. I'm Leonard Lopate talking with Marion Seldes, Brian Murray, and Edward Albee here on WNYC 93.9 AM 820. We're online at WNYC.org. Marion and Brian are appearing in a play by Edward Albee and also three monologues from Beckett in Beckett Albee. Now at the Century Center for the Performing Arts at 111 East 15th Street in Manhattan. I'm addressing this to both of you, Brian and Marion. There's the sheer tour de force of the words in the Beckett, these monologues. I'm not going to ask the question of how one memorizes that, because that's an actor's job, but is there a way you approach a monologue that is so circuitous, that's different from working on a more linear kind of text?
Well, in my case, I approach it through the punctuation, and in a way to memorize it, I approach it through the mnemonics of it. And there are a lot of vowel sounds and consonantal sounds that have helped me, because there is no real connection. There is every sentence on its own makes wonderful sense, but then why does he go on to the next sentence? So very often, just as my kind of Cliff Notes thing I use. I say, he stands there staring out, stock still, staring out, nothing stirring in that black vast. I use the ST sounds just to and guide me through.
Mm-hmm. And the consonants are important, even in, obviously they were important to Beckett, otherwise he wouldn't have put those alliterations
like
there.
That. Exactly. So they're very important to
him. I don't
him,
know of a playwright who hears more precisely than Beckett does. He hears so precisely exactly what he wants us to hear.
They're saying there's a musicality here. Is that how you do it too, Marion?
I was so daunted in the beginning. I learned it, and then I began to forget it. It was really scary. I thought, well, I've got 8 pages that I've got. And I had someone come and help me long before rehearsals. And then I didn't have them. It's bewildering because I did not have a technique for Beckett. I don't know if I can say...
Does anyone?
I don't know. I was going to say I don't know if I do now. But the play, the words carry you on. There's nowhere else to go. There is no other word to say. The one thing is, I like to study by myself, and when you look down to see if you've done it right, you know, it's embarrassing alone to be sitting with a text and not have gotten it right, because it's perfect the way he wrote it. It shouldn't be any different. And I think the Beckett estate is wonderful because it watches out after his plays.
They don't want you to change a word.
A word or what he has designated in the stage directions.
Is Edward's language difficult to handle?
Well, it's equally brilliant, of course.
Is it harder to memorize than most?
No.
Absolutely.
And the other thing is, a monologue, apart from a play, is not the same thing as acting with a partner. When you have a partner, he gives you your part to play.
Yeah, but we do have monologues.
Yes.
In Counting the Way, as we did in Play About the Baby.
But in most of my, what I say, I feel you're listening.
Oh, yes, I am.
I mean, even if you're off stage is what I mean.
But I think that the joy of Edward, the challenge of Edward's writing, if I may say so in front of him, is that he has...
I'm not listening.
...amazing clauses. All the conditional and subconditional and clauses and the dialectical thinking that he has.
And you have to pay attention not just to the words, but to the punctuation,
to the punctuation,
pauses, the capitalization.
To the thoughts, to the subtext. Mm-hmm. There's a very, very strong subtext. Sometimes he appears to voice the subtext completely in the text, but then there's another one lurking somewhere else. It's easy to speak because they speak like human beings.
But can you approach the text in the same way you would in a so-called realistic play?
I never think of one play of another play when I'm doing one play. I feel shy to answer the question. It's new. It's always new.
All characters, if they're well written, no matter what the style of the play is written in, they're all real and three-dimensional.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you have to find the realism wherever it is. Mm-hmm. I think that there's a... if you by not realistic, you mean like surrealistic.
No, I meant the kind of Padashevsky sort of realism or those Arnold Wexler plays that were so popular in Britain in the
Wesker.
Past. Wesker. Was it Wesker?
Yeah, Arnold Wesker. Yeah.
The Kitchen, things like mm-hmm. that.
Yeah, mm-hmm. yes. Well, that's...
Well, you felt like you just wandered into some situation and you were seeing a documentary almost.
Mm-hmm. Yes. No, thank God Edward is like that. It's heightened. It's heightened and very, very rich language to speak, but it's very human.
What does an Edward Albee script look like?
Clean. It's absolutely clean.
Does it give you many or any stage directions?
Yes,
or clues
a few.
As to who the people are?
A few. Oh, well...
Because these people are he and she, and rarely do the characters in an Albee play even have names.
Well, here's the problem.
You're the man who knows why that is.
Yeah, here's the problem. I've written, 28 plays now, and I've probably written over 150 characters. There aren't that many good names around. And also, if you've got a married couple, you know, most married couples don't call each other by name very often.
All the time, no.
When they're in a room talking with each other, maybe if they're calling off stage or into another room, most marriages don't take place on stage, you see. But most married couples are people who are living together, who know each other. They know each other's names, and so they don't use them.
Yeah.
And you've written probably as many plays about marriages as any playwright there is, don't you think?
I've written quite a few. Yeah.
One critic has called you the master chronicler of bad marriages. Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, a delicate balance
that's
marriage
not a bad
play?
Marriage. That's a very good marriage in trouble.
Uh-huh. The Lady from Dubuque, and I don't even know if we can say that Three Tall Women is also about marriage. It is on some level.
Well, it's the atomic structure of our society.
And you've called this Counting the Ways, obviously referring to the Elizabeth Barrett Browning play. Of course, she asks that question asks the question in that poem.
How do I love it? Let me count the ways.
Very early
in
a relationship.
Brief scenes,
and here we have rather late in the relationship where they obviously have affection for each other, but they're also about to sleep in separate bedrooms.
Well, not because they want to. Time happens, as somebody else said in another one of my plays.
Yes.
Time happens, and all of a sudden you find yourself in separate beds and then in separate bedrooms, and it has not much to do with what you want, necessarily.
But you wrote this when you were much younger. This is from 1976, isn't it?
Yeah, when I was very young, I took a chance and wrote about a lot of people who were older than I. And now that I'm very old, I write about people who are a lot younger.
I try to use my memory. When was it first performed in New York?
This play? Mm-hmm. It had its world premiere in Hartford at the Hartford Stage Company with me directing with Bill Prince and Angela Lansbury. And then it wasn't done in New York until the Signature Theater. I did that whole season of mine about 1980-something.
Because it's hard for me to imagine anyone else playing these roles now.
When you get the right actors, it's very difficult to imagine anybody else.
Was the obvious chemistry between Marion and Brian a reason you decided to revive it?
No, I think Elizabeth McCann, who produced it, and Larry Sacaro, who directed, had read the play and liked it very, very much and wanted to do it. And I don't remember which came first, the Beckett or the Albee or whatever. Doesn't concern me. It's just such a happy combination.
Mm. But they obviously have a real affinity for your work.
Oh, these two?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. You've
described it as an ability to handle the language.
I always resist the temptation of writing a play for them. An awful chance they might not want to do it.
Oh, Edward.
Because I never write for actors. I mean, I don't write against them, but I never write write a role specifically for an actor in case their agent won't let them do it.
Yours is the only other voice we hear during the performance. Did you cast yourself in that role?
Of course. Yes.
Why would you want to insert yourself? Obviously, the character is the playwright.
These are stage directions, and when the characters, the actors have to break character and no longer talk to the audience as characters but as themselves, it is the author who is instructing them to do it. So who better to announce it?
And that's always been in the play?
Yes, of course.
Does it, Marion and Brian, does it change every night for you?
Yes, it does for me.
I'd assume that some actors like this sort of thing more than others because it must be difficult to suddenly have to play yourself after you've been playing someone else.
It's daunting, and it always surprises me.
Oh, you don't prepare it in advance?
Oh, yes, I do. I mean, I prepare how I will begin it, which is suggested in the script by Edward Albee, and then it happens. And I do it really for Brian as much as the audience, because I don't want to say the same thing every night for him to hear. And
yes.
then
you don't want to bore him.
No, I don't want to bore her, so that's why we change it.
And we just seem to know when it's enough, and Brian's much more daring than I am. And afterwards, I love it. When I'm doing it, I don't want them to think I'm a fool, but I want to keep amusing them. And it doesn't seem to be too hard to do. You just send yourself up. They like that.
Well, I felt there was a total transformation in the way the both of you presented yourselves. You suddenly you really were Brian Murray and Marion
yes.
Seldes, and then the play resumes and you're back into those characters. Your bodies actually changed.
That's why it was so much fun to write that scene. having broken the fourth wall, yeah. with the characters talking to the audience.
You break the fourth wall at the very beginning.
Why not break a fifth wall?
Yes. and I think of it as the Pirandello moment of the play.
It probably is.
You break that fourth wall right at the beginning because Marion asks Brian, or she asks he, a question, and he doesn't seem to want to answer, and then he points to the audience and says, oh.
I don't want to talk about it right now and in front of these people.
It's so interesting about that improvisatory scene where the actors talk to the audience as actors. Some actors love it and some hate it.
I heard Angela Lansbury
Angela, when I directed her at the world premiere, she hated that scene. She didn't want to be naked, so to speak, emotionally naked out there. And so she barely went saying, my name is Angela Lansbury and I hate this improvisation. She went out, which was something. But when we did it in London, there was a wonderful, wonderful cast of Michael Goff and Beryl Reed, two extraordinary troopers and extraordinary performers. Beryl didn't like it a lot at first. She didn't want to reveal herself. But by the end of the fifth performance, we practically had to get a hook to her off stage. She would go on for 10 minutes if we let her.
But it's seductive. If they react and if they laugh, it's lovely.
Now, when you say if they, we're talking about the audience. And the audience, I get the feeling, Edward, that you often think of the audience as a character in your plays.
Well, quite often they are whenever I break the fourth
wall. Certainly they are in
this. Yes, certainly they are.
Not all playwrights want that. They want that kind of magical.
When Brian and Marion did the play about the baby, Brian has a scene both in the first act and the second act where he asks for a response from the audience at the beginning of the second act. Is this where I was standing at the end of the first act? Mm-hmm. And he wants the audience to tell them, say, not quite there, a little over to the left.
That's right. They did, and they responded, and they always asked whether I had been improvising that. And I didn't change a syllable,
Well, that's because of the precision of the language again. What happens?
If you're writing a play, you've got to have fun. You've got to enjoy yourself while you're doing it. And with any luck, that fun will translate itself into the actors and then to the audience.
Now, we talked about how the Beckett people insist that not a word be changed. You've directed some of your own plays, and then other people have directed them. Directors notoriously are. Sometimes want to change words. Actors definitely want to change words. How strict are you?
Actors don't necessarily want to change words.
Oh,
actors,
only in the movies, I guess.
Actors change words if they can't handle the complexity of a text.
Or if they've done a lot of television and a lot of movies in which they are encouraged to improvise.
Mm-hmm. You know, nobody goes around. I keep using this analogy. Mm-hmm. No string quartet will be rehearsing the Beethoven C sharp minor quartet, and the violist will not suddenly stop and say, right here, I don't
feel it.
I don't like that D natural. I think I'm going to play an F sharp. Nobody dares to do a thing like that in a piece of music. Why? There are some actors. Unless they're in such a terrible play that they have to improve it. But in a fairly decent play, why actors feel that they have the right to
they
do a thing
They don't have
that.
The right, do they?
They
the Dramatists Guild prevents them from doing it.
Well, we have
but great,
but
even huge they, stars it, do sometimes.
When you're dealing with language that really works.
If it works, why?
You
why?
Don't mess around with Shakespeare.
No,
you don't mess
not.
Around with all these. It's true. And the rhythms are always so perfect that one syllable extra, you can feel it. It jars. Mm-hmm.
So how long is this an open run?
It's an open end run as long as people keep coming, and they don't seem to be slowing down.
Well, the reviews were quite wonderful, and that has
suspiciously
to,
good.
Yeah, I know. Well, there was a time when you were so unhappy with the way your work was being received that you stayed out of New York for a time.
Well, it was very interesting for the first 20 plays or 15 of my plays. I never got better than mixed reviews. Ever.
And now they're all considered classics.
Generally speaking, now when these plays are done again, everybody forgets that they got mixed reviews before, and the plays somehow seem to have gotten better.
And so you were disheartened by that, or you just felt that Broadway
was not a cruel place?
No, I was
not disheartened. I long ago learned that there are times when you're in fashion, out of favor, and as long as you have some sense that you're still doing reasonably good work, you go about your business. Mind you, when that 10-year period when I wasn't having performances in New York because every time they tried to put a play on of mine, they'd lose their shirts for doing it. But I was getting productions in Europe and all over the United States, just not in New York City. But that didn't discourage me.
Did things change with Three Tall Women? Did New York suddenly start embracing you after that success?
Yes, sure. Oh, yes. And why has he been away? Forgetting it was they who made me be away.
Meanwhile, I hope that someday you do consider writing a play for these two marvelous actors, because they're so great in your plays.
I certainly never write one against them.
I want to thank you both, all three of you, in fact, so much for being here. We've been talking about Beckett Albee. We could have been Albee Beckett, A to B, but we're going from B to A.
B to A. Honor for the great man.
And my great thanks to Edward Albee, to Marion Seldes. Pronounce the name correctly, Ron?
You perfectly.
Well, you on the night I went to see you, you talked about how everybody pronounces your name wrong.
Yes,
it's my own fault.
I let them. I say people say this is Marion Seldes, who is appearing in Edward Albee's Pulitzer Prize play, and I think now that's three mistakes.
Well, nobody can get Brian Murray's name wrong anyway.
They can try.
Yes, they call him Brian Murphy.
They do. Yes.
Well, Eddie Murphy, thank you so much for being with us. Beckett Albee, Century Center for the Performing Arts at 111 East 15th Street. It's been a pleasure talking to you guys again.
For us, too. Thank you.
Anybody ever call you guys before?
No.
I'll never do it again.
They call me you guys all the time.
The playwright Robert Anderson once said about writing for the American theater, "You can't make a living, but you can make a killing." My next guest is one of the few people whose career clearly defies that axiom. Arthur Miller has not only made a living as a playwright for the last 50-plus years, but with plays like The Death of a Salesman, A View from the Bridge, All My Sons, and The Crucible, his astute moral vision has enriched our understanding of the human condition and secured his place as one of this century's most influential and humane writers. But his rare talent has not only included writing for the stage. There are screenplays, essays, a memoir, a children's book, a novel, and occasionally a short story. Now he returns to that form in a new collection entitled Homely Girl, A Life. The publisher is Viking, and I'm honored that Arthur Miller could join me today on New York & Company. Hello.
Hi.
The publication of this book coincides with a reissue of your memoir, Time Bends, and a new edition of The Portable Arthur Miller, all in time for your 80th birthday celebration. So let me begin by wishing you a happy birthday.
Thank you.
I'm curious why at this juncture the newest work is not a play but a short story. Why return to that form now?
Well, the tale itself doesn't lend itself to the theater, or so I thought. And it's spread out over a period of time from the 30s into the late 60s or early 70s. Mm-hmm. And so it seemed to want to be written about in prose rather than in dialogue on a stage.
And a story occurs to you, and then you have to sort out how you're going to...
Well, it sort of speaks to its form, sort of say it's some of them want to be stories and some of them want to be plays. I think it's essentially a question of the time, manipulation of time, which is quite different in the dramatic form than in the prose forms.
Early on, you experimented with several forms. There was a book of reportage called Situation Normal and then a novel focus, but you seem to be primarily drawn to writing for the stage.
Yeah.
Why do you think that's been the case?
Well, it's a question of one's talent, I think, finally. Mm-hmm. Some of us are driven in that direction by several forces, one of which is probably that you're an actor, manqué, and you write parts that are really expressing that part of your personality.
And that's different than writing dialogue in a short story or a novel?
Much, yes. There's a question, the clock is running on dialogue in the theater. Mm-hmm. There's no clock running on a novel. You can put it down, you pick it up next week or a year from now. But you're in the theater, the form is dynamic. It's the difference between, let's say, a painting and a film. See, the film is continuous, it's dynamic, it's one thing happening after another. The painting is making a single statement.
And then theater, of course, is collaborative as well. So I wonder when you consider a play complete, when you finished writing it, when it's produced, or is it never completed because each new production brings a whole new...
Well, it's generally speaking abandoned, basically what happens. You carry it to the point where it seems to be as good as it's ever going to get, and that's it. Now, that could be the day before you go into rehearsal. It could also be the day the play closes. Mm-hmm. It depends.
And when you see a new production of a favorite that takes a whole new tack, does that make you feel there's still life in the old guy? Or?
Well, there's life in it, but I wouldn't want to change anything if that's what you're driving at.
You've abandoned it and let it live by
itself.
And
the other ones pick it up. Uh-huh. Yeah.
When you were young, your real passion was baseball, and yet I'm not sure, except for a couple of passing references, that you've ever really written about sports.
No, my interest in it died off many years ago. It was a youthful thing. I was always interested in sports. But I found as time went on, I lost that interest a lot, excepting now and again when the World Series is on, but even that it fails to draw me anymore.
And as a young man, you worked in a warehouse for a while. That's when baseball was replaced by reading. Harold Clurman said that you were probably the only man who read through War and Peace on the subway standing up. Is that true?
Yeah, more or less. Sometimes I sat down if I was lucky.
The Brothers Karamazov was an early inspiration. What is it about the Russians for you?
Well, they're the best novelists, for one thing. And their stories were dark enough to attract me at the time. It's just great novel writing.
And usually they're dealing with moral issues and
well,
ideas.
They're dealing with life in a way that attacks the mystery of it and the religious side of it, which is transcendent. And that's very interesting to me.
Mm-hmm. The religious side is, do you think there's a God presiding over this moral universe?
Nobody told me about him, if he's around. Uh-huh. I don't
so you,
think
when you say religion,
terms.
You're not saying necessarily
no, it's
God,
just a transcendent feeling that there's more than we can see, and I think there is.
In discussing your work, Harold Clurman called lack of responsibility a sin. Is that how you see it?
Well, in these situations that I have dealt with in certain of the plays, it is, I wouldn't call it a sin, but it's what destroys the world that those people are living in.
You say in Time Bends that you think in society there's got to be one righteous man, a whistleblower. And those are your heroes, or that's Arthur Miller?
Well, I don't think it's me. It's people who do that I respect very much. Mm-hmm. But that comes out of the Bible, too, of course. If that guy vanishes, the world will end.
So you're a religious man without a God?
More or less, yeah.
All My Sons was kind of like your litmus test about a career in theater. You said that if it didn't fly, you'd give up writing for the theater. Could you have considered doing anything else in retrospect?
Well, I then wrote a novel called Focus after that. Well, before that, excuse me, after my first failure. But I could have written other things, yeah, but the theater was very exciting in those days. Mm-hmm. The general public went to the theater. It wasn't simply a group of a clique, which I think is largely become now. You could find all sorts of people in the seats. And,
well, it's less expensive, at least the cheap seats
were
a lot
less expensive. Well, I was about to say, yeah. It was $4, $6, $8. And school teachers could afford to go, and students could afford to go. Now, I went to the theater a couple of weeks ago, and I paid $40 off Broadway. Well, I regret that. I shouldn't have done it.
I remember going to see some of the greatest productions of my youth on my GO card from high school. I saw A Long Day's Journey Tonight, the original production on Broadway, and many other amazing things. all, I don't know how much money we spent, but it probably was about $4.
Yes, it's a sort of scandal which nobody wants to talk about. I was talking to Cameron McIntosh, who's a producer of Les Miserables and five or six other mega hits, the other day in Oxford. And I asked him if he had any idea what the differential in the costs were between producing that play, a play, in a musical in London and in New York. And he said, well, yes, it's the London cost is one-third of what it is in New York. It's the same show, mm-hmm. same set, same number of actors. I said, you have any idea why? He said, oh, yeah. I said, we know why. I said, why? He said, waste. The money is thrown into the sewer, in effect. Mm-hmm. So
waste, and some people blame the unions. I can't imagine Arthur Miller would blame the unions.
Well, I would if they were to blame, sure. There's, some of them are, but there's also a lot of greed on the part of people who have no connection with unions. It's a mess.
Mm-hmm. It's just simply a lot of people who have driven up the cost of plays
sure.
right now, and that's the reason why they say you can't do drama.
Well, it's
Broadway.
Also that we don't have any kind of a subsidized theaters. That creates a base from which costs are calculated in London. They've got about five well-subsidized, highly professional, high-level theaters. And their costs are what their costs are.
Mm-hmm.
So everybody's gauges it accordingly.
I'm told, or I read somewhere, that Newt Gingrich was talking to Wendy Wasserstein about why there shouldn't be government support for the arts, and he said, well, Arthur Murray wrote all of his plays without any government support, and people were so intimidated, nobody was willing to correct him.
Incredible,
and say that
huh?
Arthur Murray may have taught you dancing in a hurry, but he sure didn't write any plays.
Yeah, well,
that led
sad.
To you writing a letter to the Times saying, well, you may not
have
gotten...
No, that was to the Nation.
Oh.
Yeah.
And you said, well, I may not have gotten an NEA grant because there was no such thing, but you did get money from government.
Yeah,
government.
I was on WPA for 5 or 6 months. And earlier than that, I was helped through college by a grant from given to the university by the federal government.
Last season, your Broken Glass did well on Broadway and won an Oliver, but it didn't fill
Olivier.
The house. Olivier, but it didn't win. It didn't fill the house every night, and so.
Well, we did about 750 out of 810 seats.
Uh-huh. But still, that was a
well.
Reason
the
to close
costs
it down.
Are so astronomical. You've really got to sell every seat.
Uh-huh. Even for a drama, we're not talking about Les Mis, where they have all of.
Oh, especially for a drama. See, with the other ones, their prices. People are willing to pay very high prices to see a musical because it's an outing and so on.
Mm-hmm.
But any serious play or even a straight comedy is not going to last very long in this theater.
You've been called an Ibsenite. Is that a fair categorization?
Oh, that was about 40 years ago.
You no longer think of yourself in those terms?
No, not at all.
But 40 years ago, you might have said, yeah, he was...
Oh, of course. I was very much influenced by him and the Greeks.
Well, Ibsen once said, and I paraphrase, to move the pieces on the chessboard is not my intention. I turn the whole board over. And you said you wanted to do more than express a feeling, to press things to the wall. So those seem to me to be similar kinds
they
of
are.
Ambitions in,
yes.
in theater.
Yes.
In both cases, to not just let a play develop in the kind of logical way or... But rather to keep on throwing things up against the wall and finding out how they turn out? I mean, was it a... I'm sorry, I'm not going to answer my own question. I do that once in a while.
Well, it's the structure of Ibsen's thought is to draw in from the past, usually, the events that have formed a person's character in his life and confront him with a dilemma due to current events in his life. That's fundamentally the Greek idea.
Mm-hmm.
And it influenced me a great deal, yes.
Well, that's why Death of a Salesman is called a tragedy by some, although that was open to big debate. Mary McCarthy said that it couldn't be a tragedy because tragedies involved kings and great men, and Willie Loman is not a great man.
Well, of course, it's ridiculous. They can involve great men. They can also involve people who are not so to speak, great. I don't think that that's the limitation at all.
You called it a tragedy of the common man.
That's right.
And I was surprised to read in your autobiography that it was that play was inspired to some degree by Tennessee Williams.
Well, it wasn't inspired by Tennessee Williams. It was written at the same time, and we were both liberated by a certain love of language, which was, so to speak, it broke open Broadway. Broadway was the only theater we had.
But didn't you say that you saw a Tennessee Williams production? I'm trying to remember what it was.
It was a Streetcar Named Desire.
And you understood how you might this problem you were dealing with, even though Tennessee Williams and Arthur Miller would not immediately come to mind as two playwrights with similar ways of approaching
theater. Well, we had a lot in common.
You think you did?
Oh, sure.
He also wrote short stories.
That's what?
He also wrote short stories, too. My guest is Arthur Miller, and his latest book is a collection of short stories, Homely Girl, A Life, and Other Stories. It's published by Viking. We'll talk more about Death of a Salesman, about his career, about writing short stories, about The Crucible, which is about to be made into a film, and how that story changes for different generations, all after we take a little break here on AM 820 WNYC, New York Public Radio. First this. We're back with Arthur Miller. His latest book, a collection of short stories called Homely Girl, A Life and Other Stories. It's published by Viking. I was trying to figure out how the dilemma of Janice, the main character of the title story of this new collection, fits in with the rest of your work. Why is beauty, or the lack of it, the metaphor of the moment for you?
Well, it would open up the idea of real values, wouldn't it?
Mm-hmm. In this case,
aside from the superficial ones.
This a woman wakes up next to her husband, realizes that he's dead. He's blind. She preferred him to her first husband, who was an intellectual, but who may have made her feel like he was doing her a favor by being with her. The blind man doesn't know what she looks like.
Right.
The
blind man is responding to something vital inside of her.
Mm-hmm. Now, I think it's going to be impossible for people to read this without thinking a bit about your own life and about the fact that you were once married to one of the most beautiful women in the world. And
it has nothing to do with it.
It's not even no kind of meditation on how beauty.
Well, there's a meditation probably by people who would read it, but not by me.
Uh-huh. This goes
That's
out of
based on a completely different kind of experience.
Uh-huh. But based on a real experience, or
yeah,
like, or do you don't want to tell it?
Well, I've told it
In the story. Oh, yes. So the story is a fictionalized version of a real event or a real.
Well, every story is, isn't it?
Well,
writers very rarely invent something out of the blue sky.
They extrapolate often from things that.
Well, the book is your signature.
Mm-hmm.
It's the effect of your life upon your mind.
The other stories in the collection are older stories. This is the new one.
Yes. One of them is out of the 60s. Well, both of them are.
That had never been collected before?
Yes, they have. Sure. They're in a collection called I Don't Need You Anymore, which is an older collection of stories.
Mm-hmm.
But this one I've just written recently.
The others were out of print, and you felt that they should be out there again?
I'm not sure they're out of print. I Don't Need You Anymore is a collection that's still in in print, I believe.
You're in print an awful lot. Right now, we have three books that have come out fairly recently.
Yeah.
The complete Arthur Miller I mentioned earlier. There's the portable Arthur Miller. Then there's the reissue of your memoir, Time Bends, and this thing, all at a time when people are really celebrating your 80th birthday. Tonight, there'll be a special event for you, won't there?
Yes, a town hall. That's just a kind of a tribute, I guess.
When is the actual birthday?
17th of October. I was in England then, though.
Uh-huh. Well, it wasn't that long ago. And the guests tonight are going to include Edward Albee, Zoe Caldwell, Carlos Fuentes, John Guare, David Mamet, Diane Wiest, Sam Waterston, who will be performing a scene from The Crucible.
Yes.
What is your feeling about the film that's coming out? Are you involved in it?
Well, I wrote the screenplay of The Crucible film, and it's now 3 weeks away from being completed. I think it's fantastic. It's a marvelous piece of work. They've got a wonderful cast.
Daniel Day-Lewis and Winona Ryder, and Nicholas Heitner is directing.
Yes, he's the one that did The Madness of King George. Mm-hmm. And Paul Scofield.
Scofield is in it as well. Heitner has done an awful lot in theater as well. And would that be important to you?
Well, it would be in the sense that he's out of the British theater, where the language is terribly important. Mm-hmm. And this screenplay is this play is taking place in 1692. So the handling of the language, ability to act and speak at the same time, is of course very important.
Most people saw The Crucible as a comment on McCarthyism. I don't know if you've ever come out and said, yes, that's definitely
the play. Oh, of course, sure.
So what do you think its relevance is today? Do you think that we're entering a new era where McCarthyism of some sort is...
Basically, that story is about paranoia. A public fear which rises to the point where people lose their sense of reality. Mm-hmm. And that's happened, it happens all the time, of course. It's certainly my most produced play, and the publisher tells me they've sold now, in the last 20 years, about 7 to 8 million copies of that play.
More than Death of a Salesman.
Oh, yeah. Sure. I think it's because probably the fear of the unknown drives a lot of social action. It doesn't necessarily drive people crazy, but it does detach them from their common sense. And there's a lot of that now.
Mm-hmm. You might see parallels to today's attacks on the NEA. I just read that the NEA... and the NEH have laid off an awful lot of people, which would indicate that it's been pretty much eviscerated.
Well, I'm not sure it applies there, because that's a question of public policy that's a little beyond this. But it does apply, for example, to the militia movement in the Middle West, mm-hmm. in Idaho and so on, where the people are walking around convinced that they're being spied on by black helicopters. And after all, the number of people who have been put away in prisons here on the charges by 4, 5, 6-year-old children.
Mm-hmm. But for people who have political commitments, even if Newt Gingrich might find them unacceptable, there isn't as much danger today. In the 50s, you testified before the House Un-American Activities Committee and were convicted of contempt. Later, that was overturned, but that was an attack on intellectuals, wasn't it? We're not seeing
certainly.
That anymore.
Well, we're getting it again now in a slightly different way. It isn't. I think the contempt for intellectual life in this country in the political sphere is worse than anything I've ever lived through.
Well, that other time has so captured our memories. I remember when Ilya Kazan was going around with his autobiography, and he objected to people asking him about that appearance, the very first question every time. He, you know, he said, "Look, I had this long, complicated career, and this is all anybody wants to talk to me about." Now, it was a very powerful moment, and I know for a long time it ended your friendship.
Yeah.
I think you said on the air that you would reconcile to some degree.
I suppose it's because that was that period was an attack on all expression. After all, the blacklist was a national policy, and it destroyed a lot of people and a lot of lives, and probably it had an impact on our psyche in general.
Why do you think that it didn't destroy your career the way it had destroyed some others?
I don't know. I suppose I never relied on the movie industry. I was never part of it. And so I couldn't be fired from some place where I hadn't been hired. I was always independent, and therefore they couldn't possibly throw me out.
Pete Gurney says that your work taught him how a writer can confirm and deny a position at the same time. In Death of a Salesman, on the one hand with Willie, it's a critique of the free enterprise system, and then Bernard works hard and succeeds. Was that something you were really conscious of doing, that developing that kind of ambiguity?
I wasn't thinking of the system quite. I was thinking of life.
Uh-huh.
People go up and people go down.
Is that what makes you to some degree different than a Clifford Odets, wonderful as he was?
Oh, we're totally different writers, I think. I think his time came before mine, and probably I would have been swallowed up as well in social propaganda of one kind or another, although he wrote far more than that. I came a generation or half, three-quarters of a generation later.
Mm-hmm. So but writing about with a strong moral sense, there's always there's a very seductive quality about polemic, and the ambiguities in not just Death of a Salesman but all of your works are what really prevent us from ever seeing them in those terms.
Well, because I was dealing with people. I've never dealt with a social problem as such. They are not plays about social problems. They're plays about people caught in or living in a society. Mm-hmm. And that's a different emphasis.
You directed Death of a Salesman in Beijing, an area, right. A country where people might read an awful lot into that play.
Well, they read some surprising things in that play, though.
Did they? What did they read?
Well, they thought Willie Loman was right.
Uh-huh.
You see, it caught them at a certain period when capitalism was being reintroduced into China, at least partially. And Deng Xiaoping was saying it's to get rich is wonderful.
So here's a play that most people see as about the pitfalls of capitalism, and the Chinese are seeing it at that moment as a play in praise of capitalism.
Of course, they're on the other side of the earth, so everything is backwards.
I guess from my perspective over here, I would have thought that all my sons would have played better in China.
No, they it's the Crucible plays there, and Death of a Salesman, some of my other plays.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know that all my son's been done, but they don't tell me everything either.
These are such American plays. It's always amazing to me how well they do in other parts of the world.
I don't think there's any such thing. If you're dealing with people, people are people no matter where you go. Mm-hmm. It's not that different.
Most people thought that the name Loman came from low man, small man, or something like that. But actually, you got it from a Fritz Lang film?
Sure.
It's spelled differently.
I was totally unconscious of it at the time. I just picked it out of the air. But I had seen a film by Fritz Lang called The Last Will of Dr. Mabuse. He's got four or five versions, and I saw one of them, which had a deep effect on me years earlier, before I wrote Death of a Salesman.
It's really about a totalitarian sensibility. Dr. Mabuza is a
is
a kind of a criminal dictator, a Hitler type, and so you wind up with Willy Loman, just this name that that stuck in your head. I'm interested in the casting because Lee Jacobs, as my parents used to call him, is such a large man. And then later, you see, we saw Dustin Hoffman in the same role, a very small man. You would have thought that Dustin Hoffman would have been the ideal
size
for that.
Yeah.
But Lee Jacob playing against type.
Well, you know, a physical description of a character is practically meaningless on stage. It depends completely on his personality and his character. Mm-hmm. And Lee had all the emotion that the character required. And in the beginning, I thought he's too big for this. But after 2 days of rehearsal, it was quite obvious that he wasn't.
Had you written, I don't remember now, had you written that he would be a small man?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I had thought originally of him. We read about four small actors, but they were too small.
At the time, it was such a powerful thing that I remember, I grew up in Williamsburg, and I remember seeing announcements for Death of a Salesman with Lee Jacob in Yiddish. They toured it in Yiddish as well.
No, it wasn't with Lee Jacob in Yiddish. It was a Yiddish company that played it for a short time in a Brooklyn theater.
Stylistically, your earlier plays were realistic, at times almost naturalistic, but you've been praised for, and you've also been praised for your journalistic details of the minutiae of everyday life, but you yourself have said that you prize the poetic above all else in the theater. And that was there from the start?
What is your question?
How did you integrate the poetry into...
Well,
realistic?
I think it comes out of the concept, doesn't it? Yeah. You can't lard poetic diction over a prosaic situation and come out with anything decent.
Did it change over the years, or did you feel that you were getting less naturalistic in the
process? I was never a naturalist. It's a completely lazy-minded attitude toward the play. the plays. I wrote one play, which I personally attached to my Ibsen adoration period, which was All My Sons. But all the plays before that and after it have been completely of a different style. I mean, I don't think The Crucible is a naturalistic play, is it? Or any of the others.
Mm-hmm. What are you doing now?
I'm in the middle of a play, God help me. I hope I can finish it. And I just came back from England where I did some lectures at Oxford.
Mm-hmm.
And those take more time than writing plays do.
Writing lectures.
Yeah.
Perhaps because you're not allowed that ambiguity that you are in a play.
Well, it's you got to be thematically clearer.
Meanwhile, tonight you'll be honored at Town Hall in a program sponsored by Penn and featuring Edward Albee, Zoe Caldwell, Carlos Fuentes, John Guare, David Mamet, and Diane Wiest and Sam Waterston, who will be performing in a scene from The Crucible. And I thank you so much for joining us so close to your 80th birthday so that we could celebrate as well.
Oh, thank you.
The book that brought you here was from Viking. It's Homely Girl, A Life, and Other Stories. Bill Irwin describes himself as both an actor and a clown, and he brings those two skills in roughly equal measure to his current solo performance of Text for Nothing, based on text by Samuel Beckett. Mr. Irwin is familiar to many of us from the hit Broadway show Full Moon, which he created with David Shiner. He's also appeared in the Lincoln Center production of Waiting for Godot, as well as numerous other stage, film, and TV roles. To the children of America, he is best known as the perpetually perplexed Mr. Noodle on Sesame Street. Mr. Irwin is credited with directing and starring in the current production, which can be seen at the Classic Stage Company on East 13th Street. And I'm delighted that it brings the thinking man's clown, Bill Irwin, back to New York and Company today. Hi.
Hi, Leonard. Thank you so much.
Mr. Noodle, I mean, this is a great thrill.
How old is your child?
Six. Is this a new direction in your career, this production of Beckett, or is this an extension of your work in the past, something that we should have seen coming?
Oh, what a good question. It's actually feels to me like a picking up of a thread that's been in my life for a long time. I had the great and amazing good fortune to get a phone call from Joseph Chaykin some years ago.
1991.
He called me, and of course, Joe is one of our great theater directors of the avant-garde, or as we at our age are now saying, any guard at all. he had gotten permission from Samuel Beckett some years back to do an adaptation of Texts for Nothing, and performed it, and still performs it on occasion in certain forms. He called me, though, to see whether I'd be interested in being directed by him in his adaptation, which were not the full texts. And I will confess now to the world that I had seen Texts for Nothing on the page, but didn't know what to make it. I'd flipped through it quickly. It was only with Joe's help that I really encountered these great pieces of writing.
Well, I'm surprised that Beckett allowed this sort of thing, because I know that he is very rigid about how his plays should be performed. And here he was allowing texts that weren't meant to be performed on the stage to be performed without any control over how they were to be done.
Well, that's very interesting. Joe tells great tales of his meetings with Beckett. And Beckett's thought on staging when they first spoke in the 70s about Texts for Nothing was that it might be delivered by a man holding his hand over his eyes and leaning into his elbows for the entire 90 minutes. Joe rejected that notion, and I also have taken it in a different direction. But it was through Joe. I have Joe to thank, a great gift, for encountering the texts. But as I got to know them as pieces of writing in their unadapted state, I felt further in love is not the right phrase. I was captivated by them further, so that when we applied more recently to the estate of Samuel Beckett for permission,
his nephew Edward Beckett,
yes, very protective and rightfully so of the writings, and it's an interesting correspondence in which I talked about adapting the texts, in which, in return, he urged me to think about performing them unadapted. And he was right. So that I'm performing, of the 13 Texts for Nothing, which are, interestingly enough, one of Beckett's least known and discussed works, written like 18 months after he wrote Waiting for Godot, possibly the most famous play of the 20th century. He wrote this piece in French, Textes pour rien, and only 16 years later did he translate it into his Irish inflected English. That's the form in which I encounter it, because I don't read French. These writings I see, and Mr. Edward Beckett was right, should be seen as they were written on the page. I have a feeling that were the author to return, he would probably go through with a red pencil, thinking of it as a performance piece, because yes, he never wrote it as a piece of theater. They're prose pieces. But I've taken it as a great challenge, and I thank Edward Beckett for putting the challenge to me, to perform four of the 13 texts unedited.
Now, since this was not written as a play, there are no stage directions. How do you begin to devise the physical production?
Another very good question. I always see Waiting for Godot and Texts for Nothing, which, as we were just saying, are one of the best-known pieces of writing in the 20th century and one of the least known, as companion pieces. Could never defend that in any scholarly way.
But since they were written around the same time, you have some kind of argument there. I was thinking about certain things.
I would hope I would, yes. So the world of Waiting for Godot in many ways informs my take as an actor and a clown on these prose pieces that were written. Some people call them fiction. Some people don't know what to call them. They're 13 texts, as Beckett called them. And so it's there's a Godot flavor, I think, or there's a Dee Dee and Go-Go flavor to the way I approach the text.
Well, since you appeared in Waiting for Godot with Steve Martin and also Robin Williams not so long ago in a celebrated production, you must have been thinking a lot about Beckett when you were working on this, although you'd done it before, and now you were coming back to it in a different form.
Exactly. I've actually performed, thanks to Joe Papp and the Lincoln Center production with Mike Nichols directing, and more recently, Seattle Repertory Theater with Doug Hughes directing. I've been involved in Waiting for Godot three times, hope to be again and again in my life, as I hope to continue to perform and ruminate on Texas for Nothing for the rest of my life.
My guest is Bill Irwin, and we're talking about a certain aspect of his career, because it's hard to imagine a guy who started off in circuses and who definitely has established himself as a clown, a great physical actor, somebody who would feel this closeness to one of the most cerebral of all of the writers of the 20th century. Now, I'm not saying you're not smart, Bill, but you understand what I'm saying here.
I do indeed. I do indeed. And it poses a very good question. You know, I love language. Actors love language, whether they use only their bodies or only their voices. And the language of the body is as intricate and perhaps more primal, more original to us than the spoken language. It's the same kind of love of intricacy, complexity, and also sudden clarity that brings me to Texts for Nothing. The language...
But I can't imagine Marcel Marceau, who is a great mime.
He is indeed. Well,
and who does similar things, ever thinking of performing Beckett. And the man speaks. He has a perfectly fine...
The man is hard to stop when he gets going. He's a most wonderful speaker about his craft and his art. But, no, his relationship with an audience is as a non-speaking performer, as has mine been on many occasions. I had the honor to share a stage with David Shiner and the Red Clay Ramblers, as you mentioned. There's something about the language, and particularly the language of Beckett. I must say, I cannot wrap my mind around the fact that he wrote them first in French, and so many of his great works first in French. He wrote Texts for Nothing in French the year I was born, which has no significance to anyone but me and my mom, but I've always found that striking. It wasn't until I was 16 years old and a sort of snotty would-be thespian that he put them into English, in his Irish-inflected English, in the form that I have become captivated by them. They are incredible pieces of writing, very simple in many ways. He uses simple language. There's a lovely line from the last text, number 13. A trace. Yes, it wants to leave a trace like air leaves, among the grass, among the sand. He's speaking of a hand. It's something called a hand that wants to leave a trace. And that's really simple monosyllabic poetry. Not long after that, he says suddenly, 13 is a wonderful text because it keeps feeling like it's going to end. Beckett is both the most erudite of poets, and he's a sort of vaudeville comic. You know, he keeps ending things. Then he says...
False endings.
False endings, exactly. In fact, for a while we had a light cue that like faded out and then came back. I thought that was a little too much. But he keeps ending. Not long after he says this about the trace of the leaves in the sand, he says, and... Who's the shame at every mute micromillisyllable and unslakable infinity of remorse delving ever deeper in its bite at having to hear, having to say fainter than the faintest murmur, so many lies? Now, that's pretty polysyllabic in places, and then returning at the end of that beautiful sentence to lies.
So many lies.
Right.
Now, the set is quite wonderful. It's a hillside made out of real dirt and water. Last year, we saw the Irish actor Conor Lovett perform a version of Molloy, which is another of Beckett's prose works.
Right.
And he did it on a bare stage. Why did you choose such a naturalistic set?
It's very interesting. When Joe Chaykin directed me in his adaptation years ago, and I have he and the Public Theater to thank for that great adventure, we had a beautiful set designed for about $2 by a young designer, Christine Jones. And it was an abstract wooden set. I've always thought the set was beautiful, but I never entirely felt the texts in relation to that set. I began thinking right then, Earth. There are so many things in these pieces, you could never name them all. Everything we would talk about today is in those pieces and then some more. But there is a question, why not lie down and join the earth?
And you really get into the earth here, starting with your spectacular entrance.
Well, I thank you for saying so. Doug Stein, who directed this set, and Nancy Schertler, who puts the light upon it, found a way somehow at the Classic Stage Company, which is a little black box theater, funky little joint, impeccably run by a great theater organization, but somehow found a way to put this mountain hillside with actual dirt, earth, in there.
They had just completed the CSC, a major renovation, and I imagine that bringing in tons of dirt didn't go over very well at first. How did you convince them?
Mr. Beckett convinced them. I just kept telling them, I think it has to be this way. They had so much renovation junk lying around that we actually trucked the dirt in almost unknown. We were rehearsing the piece while Doug was welding the structure that makes this hillside while the workmen were finishing the renovation. It was an exciting theater time. It's a very exciting theater time in America right now, and if I may grasp this opportunity, this privilege of being on WNYC and New York and Company, to say, in America is right now, for many actors, certainly for this actor, it's the best of times, the worst of times. Every night I get to negotiate this piece of Mr. Beckett's writing, thanks to CSC and thanks to the Beckett Estate. It's a great adventure. I'm also an associate artist with the Roundabout Theater. I also, as actors love to say, I have a movie coming out, which is typical inflation for, actually, Universal Pictures has a movie coming out, and Ron Howard, who's worked a couple of years of his life to put this movie together.
What is that?
How the Grinch Stole Christmas with Jim Carrey.
Back to the Kids.
Back to the Kids, yes, from Beckett to Seuss. And it's an I haven't seen the movie yet, so I can't vouch for it being...
Are you the Grinch?
No, Mr. Carrey is the Grinch. I'm one of the Whos. I'm the postmaster of Whoville and the father of Cindy Lou Who, an amazing actress. This is an amazing company from top to bottom, but I worked often with this, many scenes with this actress who is one of the most professional actresses I've ever worked in. She's six. Her name is Taylor Momsen. I will only imagine terrific in the movie because, like I said, I haven't seen the movie yet. All these things, very exciting. My wife and my son and I are buying a new car this week. It's an exciting time, and yet it's the worst of times for actors because the proud professional guild of which I've been a member for 25 years, the
Screen Actors Guild.
Exactly. We find ourselves with no choice but to be on strike.
And you're wearing your SAG pin.
Always.
We've talked about the strike and its reasons.
I thank you for doing that
because
it's actually hard for the public to get some of the issues. Besides,
we have Robert Klein here.
Ah, a good spokesman and a funny man. It's an interesting thing. The strike and Samuel Beckett are not as separate as one might think. As I'm running from a picket action or a rally to get to rehearsal, I often have thought, I'm leaving one world that has no touch with the other world. I suddenly remembered one day, poring over this Cambridge Companion to Beckett, which has been in my clutches the entire time.
Yeah, you walked in here.
Yeah, exactly.
I would have thought by now you'd know Beckett by heart. You'd have enough Beckett.
It's close to my chest most of the time. But as I ran from a Screen Actors Guild job action, rally or set of speeches, picket action, talk of a boycott, unfortunately, down to CSC on 13th Street, you know, it struck me suddenly, Beckett was, in many people's estimation, the most apolitical of writers, and yet he was awarded the Croix de Guerre, one of the few non-French nationals. And right after the war, in his work with the Underground, which he shrugged off most of the time in discussing, he went to work for the Irish Red Cross in the aftermath of the decimation, of the destruction of the Second World War in Europe. He was a sort of, as you mentioned, a kind of a one-man movement in a way for the protection of intellectual property rights, which is one of the big issues, and one of the larger issues in the SAG labor dispute. The world, you know, is not so separate as we often make it, and there is a big Beckett theme, because I came to Beckett thinking, wow, this is just a great Irish poet. This is how I encountered him. Couldn't, as I say, wrap my mind around the fact that he wrote as a French symbolist first, often. This is a great Irish writer. I'm an Irish American. I have some affinity here. There's something about mortality that speaks to me, but more recently I've gotten in touch with, sometimes with the help of other critics, because Beckett is helpful. He's very erudite and funny and helpful. to the soul on the subject of the Cartesian dilemma of separation. He began, Mr. Beckett began a dissertation on Descartes and never finished it, in which he took on the phrase cogito ergo sum, I think, therefore I am, which is what Descartes gave us and how he defined us. The problem with that definition is if I think, therefore I am, then after a while I'm tempted to think that only my thinking is me, and that's the dilemma we find ourselves in the late 20th and now early 21st century. Are we thinking machines? What is our relationship with the other parts of us?
My guest is Bill Irwin, and he is now starring in in Text for Nothing, which are adapted from some prose pieces. In fact, it's not adapted. It's pretty much the same words. We should make that point. At the CSC on 13th Street. Well, Billy Whitelaw was here, and she also worked in dirt in a Beckett play, Happy Days. But she couldn't move. I can't imagine you taking a part like that, where you would be buried up to your neck in dirt and just have to deliver your lines.
There is a certain short section of the text in which I find myself in that same position. However, I'm with you. I can only get there by means of a very physical...
Right. At the end, you are doing a kind of a talking head thing, but you've done an awful lot of physical stuff before you get to that point.
I'm pooped out, I'll tell you by the end, and dirty, as you said. I always find a spiral in Mr. Beckett's work, a helpful sort of shape to keep in mind. So there's a very physical bit of action that begins the evening. It spirals down to inaction, to the beautiful cadences of text 13. It is one of the most exciting performances and most challenging performance bits I've ever been part of.
Now, he also Beckett seems to have been interested in something that you, Marcel Marceau, are interested in, and that is the world-weary tramp, clown.
Yeah.
I don't know whether he loved Charlie Chaplin. I love Charlie Parker and Charlie Chaplin. But whether he loved Charlie Chaplin as much as I'm sure you do and Marceau does. But do you see that as part of the aesthetic here?
Yes, it's interesting. Many commentators on Beckett say, well, he never actually said these guys were tramps. And it's true, no stage direction says so, but many of Beckett's comments, Beckett's letters to Jackie McGowran, when McGowran performed an evening of Beckett in the 70s, said, oh, Jack, don't worry about the fact that you had to shave your head for that movie. I think it'll look as if the poor fella had had his head shaved for lice or some reason. There seemed to be a tramp notion somewhere, clearly, in Beckett's storytelling. And yes, there are moments when I think, here's my Chaplin moment, and it's perfectly appropriate for an elucidation of Beckett's text.
There is, in addition to the existential despair, a lot of comedy in these texts.
Nothing's funnier than unhappiness. That is one quote of Mr. Beckett's.
But how much is inherent in the lines, and how much of it is in your delivery of them?
Very good question. You're faced with a great responsibility with a text this dense and resonant. The words can, Beckett, as a modern deconstructionist writer, is famous for his squinting modifiers. A phrase can qualify the phrase before it or the phrase after it in many different ways. And what I've found often is that if you try to be responsible to every possible resonance, it's like the jazz player at the piano who tries to get every note into the chord. You come up with mud, and you come up with a kind of a turgid mass. Sometimes Beckett is performed in a monotone to be respectful to the actor, to the author's every possibility. I better serve the material, making clear choices and really inhabiting the dilemma of this, the really richly comic dilemma. If I can just tell you, in text 13, there's that beautiful phrase which I'll get to speak tonight. A trace, yes, it wants to leave a trace, like air leaves, among the grass, among the sand. Now that's French or Irish symbolist poetry in a way. Early in the first text, there's this great line, I say to the body, up with you now, and I can feel it struggling like an old hack foundered in the street. I say to the head, leave it alone, stay quiet. I should turn away from it all, away from the body, away from the head. Let them work it out between them. That's a vaudeville.
But we're also back to the Cartesian thing.
Exactly.
Mind-body separation.
Exactly. It was Cartesian vaudeville. That's Beckett in a way.
So in this piece you do, text 1, 9, 11, and 13.
Right.
Did you find those to be the most conducive to this kind of adaptation? Would you ever imagine doing the others in sets of four?
Absolutely, absolutely. In fact, at one point I was going to do 1, 4, 9, 11, and 13 for various reasons. The texts are so interwoven that taking them out of context is actually tricky. They refer back and forth to one another. They're not hermetic unto themselves. So actually it's a dream of mine, especially sitting here in your studio, to record them all 13, for, you know, an audio recording someday. And
which would be wonderful for guys known for his physical comedy.
The irony there, I'd enjoy designing the CD cover.
Do you do that too?
I haven't yet, but I would love to.
This is the first offering in the CSC season. The others are two plays about the Holocaust and a Philip Glass work set in a penal colony. So Text for Nothing is billed as the comic relief of the season. Do you see it that way?
I haven't had time to see this little adventure of ours in the context of their whole season, although I'll be there for the rest of the season. Classic Stage Company on 13th Street is a terrific joint. It's under great management at the moment and artistic direction at the moment. And
newly refurbished, we should point out.
Newly refurbished and air-conditioned, so those people who've been there in the past can come without their oxygen bottles. It's it's a great place to see theater, 180 seats. Barry Edelstein, the artistic director, has chosen this season very carefully. As I say, I've had my head in the Beckett sand, so I don't know how it's going to resonate. Text for Nothing is a terrifically funny evening. If there's no laughter, I know I'm not doing my job right. If there's too much of the wrong kind of laughter, I know I've fallen off the fine line and I'm not doing my job right.
You become Zero Mostel.
Well, that would be a great compliment. But Mr. Mostel would have to work within the confines of Mr. Beckett here. And the confines are actually they're widening every night. They get wider and wider.
You say that you want to keep on performing them again and again to continue to reflect on them because you don't really understand these texts, which I find interesting too. But that's very different from what most actors say, which is I try to figure it out and then I try to keep within certain boundaries as I continue performing a piece. This production will be at the Classic Stage Company at 136 East 13th Street until November 5th, and then I hope you'll come back and talk about your next project.
Thank you, Leonard. I'll be here, and I'll be on 13th Street every night with great joy as an actor.
Bill Irwin, Text for Nothing at the Classic Stage Company. Thanks again.
Thank you.